I'm Mike Gillis.
And I'm Casey Doran. And this is Radio versus the Martians.
So Elon Musk fired somebody for telling him he was less popular than he used to be as an explanation for why he has less engagement for his tweets.
I saw that. And the engineer was simply trying to explain to him why his stats were down. And you tell Elon something he doesn't want to hear and looks like your career is going to be shortened. He's quite the man-child and takes it out on everyone around him.
I mean, he's a special birthday boy, and the birthday boy is the cleverest and handsomest person in the room because his mommy told him so, and because people will get fired if they don't repeat it. And
as much as rich people often do have a real ability to bend reality to their will, sheerly through flexing their wealth and using their status and influence over others to suggest that it's somehow the Twitter employee's fault that his engagement's down, his stats are lower, he's not the most popular person on Twitter or not getting the engagement he thinks he should, is astonishing. At least it would be to a reasonable person.
Yeah, but I mean, he is not a reasonable person.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a bit more of a ride. The thing is, though, I think people have even gotten sick of him as the main character of social media.
Yeah. I feel like his fan base is turning on him a bit, and which we saw with his appearance at the Dave Chappelle show as well. He really thought he was going to go up there and just have 18,000 people kiss his ass, and it didn't happen.
When you live in a world where 90% of your interactions with other human beings are employees of you, you might come away believing that you actually are really, really funny and really, really popular. And then when there's a crowd of people, whether it's online or in person at a Dave Chappelle show, they don't have to do what you say because you can't fire them. Yeah. You can't threaten their livelihood. And he actually pulled a fucking Dennis Reynolds, where he went up on stage and they were doing the, "You can't boo me, I'm rich." And it's like, that's, you know, that'll make them boo you more. It's the kind of like misunderstanding of people that the people who make pro wrestling do understand. There are certain things that a pro wrestler can do to get cheers or boos from the crowd. Bragging about how smart you are. Bragging about your net worth. These are all things that bad guys do.
Yeah. The heel, right?
Yeah.
That's heel behavior. And you can't go up there and unironically do this and be like, why don't they love me? I have all of the money. I collected every last American dollar.
You can't boo me. My watch cost 12 grand.
Don't you know who my father is?
I got expensive shoes on.
You'll never work in this town again.
Like, this is also movie villain lines.
Yeah.
I've noticed that there's a through line there. I was thinking about, you were saying, well, you can't intimidate people by firing them. And then, of course, Trump made his sort of pop culture persona around, like, I like to be able to fire someone in a spectacularly assholish way. And then my brain goes back just a little bit further to Mitt Romney. And Mitt Romney is like, at some point in time in the debates, he's like, I like firing people. And you have to imagine that for a certain human being, they're just like, you go to admire someone who the thing that they enjoy doing the best is depriving someone of income for them and their family. They might have to move. They might have to get turned out on the streets. I like that ability. And I think that someone who wields that ability is my kind of guy.
But to go on TV and to say, I like firing people, the one thing you have going for you is you're putting it out live on television. And the people who are hearing it are not in a position to cut the brakes of your car.
Right. And it's he does this on a show Trump did that was designed around making him look cool, right? If you are on any type of reality television, it's very produced and they take the cut that makes you look the coolest and they're coaching you and they're telling you what to say. And so everyone in the room is cowering and they want to please him so much and they just know he's the authority. He's the final say. He can kick you out at a moment's notice. And that kind of power appeals to a weird kind of person.
Well, is it the temporarily embarrassed millionaire thing, which is that the people who like him are never people who could be, and in all these three guys.
Well, it's
people like him could never actually be them because they're just not true sociopaths. But somehow they can, like, they have this shared sort of like vicarious thing of being like, oh, I would really like to be aspirational. I'd really like to be that kind of asshole.
Yeah, I think that's exactly this is. You've described the mentality of objectivists,
the chuds.
Yeah, but they have it all backwards. That he's showing them, these people that dare to approach him and think they deserve to be in his presence, and that you have the audacity to think that I would give you my blessing and my assistance and my help. Well, I'll show you. Everything in society must appeal to the rich and the powerful in the minds of a certain type of person.
I mean, I can understand why when you want to read a story, you have a strong, smart, capable hero, and you want to see, because you want to see yourself in that. It's a different story when it's real people, not a fictional person in a book in a galaxy far, far away, but it's real people who are making real decisions that are affecting your life.
Yeah,
there's a difference
there.
But
it's also the fantasy that the real smart, capable people are those people who are making those decisions, rather than maybe there was a person in the distant past who was really good at killing people, and then many, 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 many generations removed, this fucking idiot is just inherited all that wealth built on plunder, and he's like, I must be really smart because I've had this pile of gold, and therefore, see, I have to be smart, otherwise I wouldn't have that pile of gold, and you must be stupid because I killed your ancestors. But it's that same bullshit. Well, while also, you know, I look at something like The Apprentice and I go, I think this is how Donald Trump is as a father, as a TV show, which is that he's largely absent. And people are scurrying around in his absence trying to curry favor for that big moment where he shows up and the doors are open for him and everyone goes quiet and I wouldn't be surprised, calls him Mr. Trump, and his kids probably call him Mr. Trump, and he comes into the room, and they all turn on each other to win his approval, and one of them loses, and then he walks away, and everyone is happy except for the person whose favor he did not curry. I mean, this TV show was built for his very specific type of ego.
But I mean, there's the point of it too, which you touched on, is it's a production where they're spending millions and millions of dollars and they're editing judiciously and they're adding the soundtracks and stuff. So it's really easy to it would be easy to make you, Mike, or me, or you, Chelsea, to be that figure in a reality show if you just had a cadre of people trying to create this reality, you know.
And I have
well
been
paid
in that,
people.
I've been in that scenario where, you know, I've spoken to the media on many occasions and I try very hard to be cautious and selective in my phrasing because I know how easy it is to take any quote and they cut me off in the middle of a sentence and put it before some really scary music and make it sound like I was like I was trying to scare somebody and be like, oh, this was a terrible experience for me, and like that's not what I was saying at all. And if you can give them so little to go on, and so they will just like take these tiny snippets and phrases and make it look that way, and it's very frustrating to look at in retrospect.
Well, for someone who cares about being seen as true and trustworthy, then yes, probably is a problem.
Exactly.
But the fact is, you don't even have to act in a sort of Real Housewives table flipping, screaming kind of way to be painted as a villain. That I've seen something like that where I forget what it was. It was like a British host said, "Okay, we're going to film a segment where I just talk to a bunch of people as house guests on a fake reality show, and then we're going to have the editor do these different passes on it, and one of them they'll make me look really charming, and another one they'll make me look like a creep." And it wasn't that hard. And you mentioned like the right soundtrack playing underneath it, the right clips, the right reaction shots from other people.
The other example that I always see is that if you watch the documentary about the lions attacking the gazelles, depending upon the perspective, you will root for one or the other. And it's the exact same animals. Then you'll be like, oh, yeah, get those gazelles, rip their head off. And then then you see the one from the gazelle's perspective, like, oh, heck yeah, man, you got to get away. Run faster, dude. I'm rooting for you. And that's all you have to do is show their perspective and play the sad music at the right time and have this really flattering portrayal of whatever side you want to. And it is it's like lawyering it, you know. The lawyer will use the same laws to defend or prosecute somebody, right, depending upon who hired them.
Yeah, then Harvey Weinstein comes in with his walker. It's, oh, look at him. He looks so sad and old. He couldn't rape nobody. And it's just like, you know, Bill Cosby, it's a miracle. He was let out of prison and he's not blind anymore.
Yeah.
Oh my God. It's a prison miracle. It's amazing. But I was thinking about this really recently about hidden camera shows.
Prison. Sorry. Hold on. I'm just processing that now. Go ahead, Mike.
Okay. I was thinking about these hidden camera shows and, how some of them can be the worst thing in the world and some of them can be a lot of fun, and then other ones, most of them I think, are really in that gray area in the middle. Because when you think about a hidden reality camera show, you're talking about a show where you didn't know you were on a TV show until after, where you're suddenly faced with a guy with a clipboard who tells you you were just on one, and you got to decide if you want your face on it or not. And that's when you know, like, on a hidden camera show, that something went badly, because a lot of people still have blurry faces. And you're like, oh boy, here we go. Because you watch a segment and everyone's signed clearly, and then you watch another segment, everyone is blurred. And I'm like, oh man, this is, we're moving towards it now. Everyone was mad at the end when they were told. But there were two shows that I was thinking about, and one of them I discovered while I was going through cancer treatment, and I was spending a lot of time at home, and this, I think True TV would play just marathons of this show over and over and over again, and I think this was the first time I was watching, like, broadcast television in a very long time, and I kind of discovered the joy of not getting to choose every single thing that I watched. And I discovered a show called Impractical Jokers. It's one of those shows that's been on for, like, 10 years, and if you don't know about it, then you've never heard of it. But the premise of this show is that these four guys who are like a part of an improv troupe, they're comedians and they've been friends since high school, make themselves the butt of the joke. So it isn't about tricking and making the rube on the street look stupid. And that's one of the things that made me really kind of dig this show, why I find it so funny, which is the idea is that one of them is out to do some sort of a task. Usually the challenge is they have a thing in their ear, and they lose if they either fail to do something or if they refuse to do something. And the people in the ear want them to fail and will try to get them to come across as an asshole or a weirdo sometimes. And sometimes they're like, he won't do this. And a lot of it is because they know each other so well. They will intentionally do things like, one of the guys is kind of a germaphobe and is terrified of cats. And they will often use those sort of things against him. But the person who loses at the end of the show, who has the most failures, it gets a punishment. And the punishment is a thing that you can't refuse. And these ones are intended to be unpleasant to go through. And one of them, for the guy who was terrified of cats, they actually strapped him down and released a bunch of cats into a room. But one of them was something as simple as, like, orchestrating a scenario where a bunch of people think you're an asshole. And you have to stand there and sort of be that asshole. Like, one of them was, you're at a Little League game, and there's an actress who's one of the players who's pretending to be your daughter, and you have to be the terrible Little League dad. And you have to yell a bunch of stuff. You have to say the stuff they tell you. It's like, come on, you want to hit that or not? You want daddy to love you? And you watch the people in the room turn on him, and you see their faces and him getting increasingly uncomfortable as people just start getting mad. And they tell him to turn to the person next to him and go, yeah, her mom's a whiner too. And you see these people, and you see the eventually the crowd turns on him and starts yelling at him. And it's him having to continue to be the asshole and looking more and more afraid that these people are going to kick his ass. But yeah, those that show where, again, who is the butt of the joke? And it's these guys.
Right,
and
I
think that's what keeps it from being kind of toxic. So that one I really like, Impractical Jokers. But
yeah,
there was another show that was kind of viral and sort of got this resurgence. There was kind of a discourse about this guy on YouTube lately. And it's Nathan Fielder. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Nathan Fielder.
Mm-mm. Nathan For You would be his most popular.
Oh, I have heard of that, but yeah. I'm not familiar with the content.
It's like a parody version of one of those like Kitchen Nightmares, Gordon Ramsay type shows where he helps small business owners who are in trouble. And the whole thing is he's playing this weird, awkward, socially weird dude who comes to give business owners ideas for how they can fix their business, but they're always these absurd, barely legal ideas. One of them was you help this small, struggling, like TV store owner guy who can't compete with Best Buy by taking advantage of the price match policy at Best Buy. By this small store would set the price of its televisions at $1 and then using that to go to getting a bunch of your friends to go to Best Buy and buy a bunch of dollar TVs to replenish the stock by matching their prices by buying out all of Best Buy's big screen TVs and then making it impossible for people to buy them for $1 at your store during the sale. And it was like you had to come in and it's like, oh, but it's black tie. So people have to go rent a tux if they want to buy the TV. And then they have to crawl through a tunnel. And at the end, finally, the TVs are in a room with a live alligator. And that was like one of them. There's a bunch of other ones, too, but they're all really strange. And it's telling a frozen yogurt shop they should have poo flavored yogurt as a special thing. It's like funny. But I kept having this voice in the back of my head while watching that because it didn't always feel like Nathan was the butt of the joke.
No, for sure.
And that was the part that really kind of started to sink in, which is that frequently a lot of the small business owners, one, they don't know. They know they're on television, but they think they're on a Gordon Ramsay type show. They don't know that they're dealing with this fucking weirdo. Because he never breaks character.
Well, therein lies the thing, which is I think he's so stilted. His demeanor is so robotic and his tone is so strange that I guess it's just the magic of what happens when you have a camera in front of someone to think of like, oh, this is normal. We're going to keep going, right? We're going to keep going. But I mean, the miracle is that people don't figure out early enough that they're like, what the fuck are you talking about?
Well, a camera can normalize anything.
Of course, sure.
If the camera's happening, people go, oh, well, I guess I'll just go along with this because there's a camera there. But because a lot of the people who, one, they're struggling, so they're in an economically precarious position. They clearly want help for their business. And they don't understand that this is like a Comedy Central show.
Right.
And a lot of them, it's kind of clear English isn't their first language. And I started, like I said, I started to have this voice in my head. And I got through like two seasons of it. And yeah, it's funny. Yeah, it's bizarre. And a lot of these ideas are absurd. Like, you can sell gas really cheap at this small gas station, but with a rebate. And you have to climb to the top of a mountain and apply for the rebate in person. And making people go on these weird hikes and stuff. That stuff is bizarre and funny, and there's a real creativity in all of these weirdly outlandish ideas. But I'm also thinking, when this show goes out, what does this business owner feel? Because this is probably the biggest advertisement that they've ever gotten. And do they feel kind of like they've been had? Does the weirdness of this show paradoxically translate into more business for them?
Yeah, just speaking as someone who's never seen the show, it sounds like this guy looks for struggling businesses and thinks, this is content potential for me. How can I kind of exploit them and prey with their emotions a little bit?
I totally get where you're coming from, but he did an HBO show, I think that started last year.
Oh, The Rehearsal?
Yeah, The Rehearsal, where it's the same guy, but the setup is different. It's not about a business, and it's not about sort of trying to be a parody of a certain type of reality show. It's he is there. He finds a person and he's there to help them for whatever the thing. And usually it's some personal problem they end up having. The first one is a guy who goes to trivia nights every week for years when he's got these friends, and he lied to them when they first met them and told them that he had like a master's degree or something because he wanted to appear smarter, and he just was sitting on this lie for years and years. And so Nathan Fielder comes in and recreates parts like his apartment and the bar that they go to for trivia night, and sits down with an actor and has the person sit down with an actor and rehearse over and over and over and over again. How am I going to do this apology? Like, how are they going to respond? And the sheer amount of effort to go in to help a person with a really, really small problem, but a big problem to them, right? A big social problem to them is great, because in the end, also the butt of joke is not on that person. The butt of the joke is on Nathan Fielder for what he has to do to get to the point of, I think I can successfully help this guy out with his lying situation. And it's pretty cool. I think if this is him doing, I don't know, some kind of recompense for treating other people in his show that way, I would think this one's a lot better. This one's at its heart, it's a lot better.
So the question I have is where is the line? Because I'm like, I know somebody's out there, oh, Mike's been infected with the woke mind virus, which I guess is the code for you should feel bad when you see something that you fear is exploitation, or you should have mixed feelings. Because I do have very mixed feelings. Nathan Fielder is a very funny dude, and his commitment to the bit is insane. The stuff he can maintain, this weirdly, robotically awkward persona, to the degree that he goes on, like, talk shows and is interviewed still pretending to be this weird dude, that you really get no hint of what he's ever really like. And it's probably just a less exaggerated version of this, maybe, to some extent.
Yeah.
But where is the line? Where is the line where humor becomes mean-spirited? Where is it that, I mean, I guess you can't make this an objective question, but I mean, I would ask both of you, where is the line where you're watching a show that is funny, that is clever, but it starts to make you uncomfortable because you're thinking about the ethical connotations of it?
For me, I think about this more lately because we live in the era of TikTok, where everything is content and everyone's a content creator, and anyone in public is just sort of liable to be part of whatever they have planned for their they might start talking to you. There was this trend on TikTok for a while where it was a thing to run around in the grocery store and throw milk on the ground and slip and fall in it. And it's like, isn't that, yeah, just for attention and, like, you know, sort of this ribald humor. But it's like, I kind of look at that and can't help but think, as somebody whose first job was at the grocery store, somebody has to clean that up, you know? And it's just weird to, and like, look at the reactions, and like, yeah, that's normal human reactions to you floundering around craving attention and chasing clout and possibly making your antics someone else's problem. So, and for the first time ever recently, I was in a coffee shop with my husband, and I saw these two young guys who look like they're in high school who are clearly filming TikToks, and they're doing a scene and they're using the coffee shop as their backdrop because they just want to be in a coffee shop for it. And they're being kind of loud and boisterous and saying ridiculous things. And I realized immediately what's going on. And afterward, they kind of saw us watching and they're like, oh, this is just a bit. We're just, and like, no, I understand. But it's like, you're part of the stage wherever you go now. That could just kind of be a thing that happens. People can film you and put it on TikTok and you could be the internet's next villain or star or something that you didn't consent to. And they will not blur your face out. So that is a little strange. We really have to be cognizant of that when everybody's got a phone now. Young people can edit videos so slick you would think they're pros. And they can churn this stuff out like within the hour, and will do anything, it seems, for likes. I always think about somebody like Logan Paul on YouTube going into the forest and filming a dead body and putting it up, and then they do their really crappy apology later. But he got his likes, he got his views, he got his follows, didn't he? You know, it's worth it to him.
It's funny, you made an example of someone who's probably one of the most notorious of that ilk, right? And what I'm just thinking, coming from having like two small kids and then mostly people I'm seeing on YouTube. There are probably Twitch streamers first and foremost. Mostly young people or people in their 20s who dress and talk young. And so when I hear stuff like that, I feel like that is what a 13-year-old or a 12-year-old would be like. This is great internet content. And we just, for me, if we can graft this question onto me, is this treating you like you're the audience of an 11-year-old? If so, and it's also supposed to be real, right? Are you treating the audience like you're an 11-year-old? Is it immature? Does it deal with humiliation? Mm-hmm. It's probably one of the biggest things, is like, it's pretty fucked up to do that to somebody else and then to get their reaction being humiliated as part of the thing that you like. That's a lot of prankers obviously do that, right? That feeling of it being like, oh, and they're humiliating someone, they're juvenile, this is like something that a child would think up of, you know, there's no commentary behind it. It's just like humiliation.
Yeah, it's like I look at this and I go, okay, I don't feel this way when I watch like Impractical Jokers that I talked about before. And they'll even have a scenario where, you know, they get hired by the business. They're getting free advertisement for this guy to pretend to be an employee at like a donut shop or a burger place or something. And like one of them was, you know, you're acting like a weirdo while ringing people up at a thing. And this guy is just being a total Karen about it. And then you see him sit down and he's texting somebody. And the guy's backstage is like, the owner just came up to me and said that guy just texted him. I guess he knows the owner. And he's complaining about James Murray Murr. He's complaining about Murr and says he's got a crazy person. He should do something about that. So they started organizing. They orchestrated a thing where they pretended that Murr had just gotten fired. And he goes out there and he goes, I just got fired. Do you know anything about that? And the guy's like, tried to play it off and stuff like that. And then they said, Murr, you already failed the challenge, but you will win if you convince this guy to text the owner back and try to get you your job back. and he failed at that too. And they said, okay, well, the last task is just go back and make a bindle stiff and walk out looking really sad. But I look at that and I don't see a lot of anything really mean-spirited in it. I was trying to think about what is mean-spirited? Why is it that we react like, I can see Richard Spencer get punched in the face all day and I feel wonderful. I can watch, you know, a guy who, you know, the guy with the, what was it? The Twisted Tea guy. Remember that viral video came out? This guy is yelling, this guy is drunk and being an asshole at a convenience store. And he's yelling racist shit at this black guy, saying the N-word over and over and over. And the black guy finally decks him in the face with this can of Twisted Tea, knocks him off. I mean, this is like a Mike Tyson's punch out star punch. He hit the start button to punch this guy with a can of tea. And the tea already, oh, brilliant sound effect. Already, it busted open.
And that's really, I think there's a difference there because you get world starred on the internet and it was very, like that happened. That was an authentic moment. And then there's all this other category of people that are always staging things mm-hmm. and trying to make it look like it was the spontaneous moment that just right. happened in public. And oh, I can't believe we got this. Yeah, and everyone is being paid, you know, everyone is part of the production. And it's so fake, but it gets millions of views and then millions of engagements of people saying this is fake. And then no, it's not. And that's what they want. All engagement is good, right? It's shoving it in your newsfeed and making it go viral.
And if you can get people mad, you become part of the discourse. And then that, because I was thinking about, like, why don't I don't get angry at Richard Spencer, obviously, getting punched in the face, or that racist guy. And I think a lot of it for me has something to do with deserving. Does this person deserve the thing that's happening? Does the racist lady who is trying to call the cops on a black bird watcher in Central Park, you know, essentially putting his life in danger. When that lady becomes the main character of Twitter and gets a lot of shit, fuck her. She knows exactly what she's doing. And she can talk about how she's a big Hillary fan. And like, by the way, that's nothing saving you, lady. But this idea that, you know, oh, I'm not a Trump person, therefore I can't be racist. And I'm like, yeah, you can. You really can. And but there's this. By the way, she did an interview a long while after that. She has learned nothing from any of this. So when somebody like that becomes humiliated, or Richard Spencer get punched in the face, great shot, by the way, kind of wiped out that guy's viability as a mainstream fascist icon, they deserve it. I don't feel bad because this person deserves a bad thing happening to them, and my schadenfreude is based on the fact that this person is actively or intending to do harm.
Rarely are the bystanders that are on the receiving end of some kind of prank or something, rarely are they anyone other than just a random person.
An undeserving person.
Yeah, I think the difference is just being, is it punching up? Someone who otherwise has an enormous amount of privilege to come out good in this situation.
Yeah.
But to come out better in this situation, and yet they're shown for who they really are.
I don't feel bad for a lot of the Borat people because he provides enough rope for a lot of people to hang himself. Like Sacha Baron Cohen, especially in recent years, targets the worst people. Like when he shows up at that like fascist Trump rally that was like in Olympia a few years ago.
Yep.
And shows up as like a right wing folk singer, and he's going to sing a bunch of songs about killing journalists. And the crowd all claps and sings along. It's an exploration of how far can I take it, and these people follow me into scary places. It's about exposing the sort of bugs under the rock. But then Sacha Baron Cohen gets found out, and they can't chase him off because he's the one who hired all the security. So they're going to not let them attack him.
And they were so mad. They were like, you know, he tricked us. And like, did he make you clap and sing along and have a hoedown to this racist song? No. And they're so mad that they just showed their ass in front of everyone. And all he did was this performance art to allow it to happen. And like you said, do I feel bad for them? Not really.
No.
They could have not participated.
And then he does, in my mind, the funniest thing a human being can do, which is leave and come back into disguise and not be found out. There's nothing funnier to me than talking to the same person while wearing a fake mustache and having that person be clueless.
And it was also, there was another layer of comedy to that because Olympia liberals are very self-styled. Oh, we're so progressive and our city has it all figured out. We don't have people like that here. Our cops aren't like that. Everything is golden. And this is the type of stuff I see from locals. You know, I've lived in Tumwater, Olympia area.
In this house, love is love and cops are nice.
And we believe in science and also we vote straight capitalist ticket every single year. But they really don't think, you know, that doesn't happen here. And sure enough, it's plain as day. Here's the evidence. It is happening here. The cops let it happen. You know, this was like peak COVID when you're not supposed to be having these maskless gatherings. And they're just running wild, doing it, whatever they want.
Cops
and that's
never wore masks.
In our capital. There it is. Explain it. I can't wait. You know, and it's, they don't want to acknowledge it. You get those blank stares and a bunch of silence from people that just don't want to think, oh, not in my town.
I'm really waiting for the next sort of period in the pandemic, which is the pandemic denialism. Now it becomes like Holocaust denialism, which is that people are just like,
it never happened.
This never heard of that before.
Well, that's
just pretend it doesn't
exist. There was a pandemic of the vaccinated. Remember, it's going to be the great die-off. Right. All you vaccinated people, they're like, this isn't happening, and you have no evidence. I mean, none of their weird reactionary claims have required evidence, so you can just say things forever.
But yeah, when Sacha Baron Cohen makes fun of people like that, when that's the goal, fuck it, I don't care. You know, Richard Spencer can get punched all day. And then I was thinking about, you know, mean-spirited to me. Mean-spirited is where you don't care if somebody deserves it or not.
Hmm.
Mean-spirited is you are making somebody the butt of the joke, and their suffering or their fear or their uncomfortableness, that's the treasure at the end of the rainbow, and you don't care if they deserve it. Like, it's like when I watch something like an old episode of MASH, and everyone is shitting on Frank Burns. Frank Burns is an asshole. He's a racist. He's small-minded. He's a coward. He's this jingoistic, incompetent, like, mean piece of shit. So when Hawkeye and BJ make fun of him, fuck it. Who cares? It's fucking Frank. Frank is a dick to everyone. He's a racist, and he's a coward. Or Arnold Rimmer getting made fun of all the time on Red Dwarf.
Right.
But then there's Meg Griffin on Family Guy, where the joke seems to be that she doesn't deserve it, where they don't really know what to do with the character, so she's constantly insulted and assaulted and attacked, and I don't really know what the joke is other than we don't know how to write this character, so we just abuse her all the time.
Well, seeing girls suffer is hilarious. And in every sitcom, you can just kind of do that, have gratuitous violence in cartoon or real life, and it's played for laughs.
Yeah, it's hard to square that with the Seth MacFarlane, with the one who can do the Orville and being like, oh, it's good. Like, what's coming out of his brain is like good. It's like a message that,
well, like
that shows
later
don't
episodes
do
of the Orville.
Later episodes, yeah. But then
in a
just,
rough
like,
start.
It's like if it's just Family Guy is just his inception, then it's like all of the worst possible kinds of humor. It's just the most base kind of humor.
Yeah, I mean, it's a leftover piece of the edgelord aughts.
Right.
I mean, where everyone was Limp Bizkit and Freedom Fries and
every... And you can call everyone slurs casually just all the time in every setting. And the glory days that...
I mean, it was the ironic anti-Semitism of a lot of early South Park episodes. There was just like... It was like a weird anti-intellectual, mean-spirited counter-revolution to the sort of pop culture of the 90s where everyone was trying to be more progressive and thoughtful, and the music icons of the day were like, you know, Tupac and Kurt Cobain, and these are guys who like have spiral notebooks full of poetry, but in the aughts, fuck all that! We're gonna shake boobs in your face and probably do a keg stand, and we're like Limp Bizkit and Kid Rock.
We kind of were driven crazy by 9/11. Obviously, that's part of it has to just be that effect of
God. We were so fucking dumb.
Oh, of course we were.
It was embarrassing. Oh my God, you imagine if that was the age where aliens made contact with us and the first thing they fucking saw was like
Limp Bizkit.
Limp Bizkit break stuff on MTV. That was the first broadcast they picked up. That's how you get an Independence Day.
They came in peace. Well, we got a chainsaw. What?
What? Motherfucking chainsaw. But yeah, oh my God. Oh, come save us, aliens.
Radio vs. the Martians is hosted by Mike Gillis and Casey Doran. This podcast is recorded in beautiful Valverde in Seattle, Washington. Our chief engineer is Casey Doran, and our editor is Mike Gillis. Our original theme music is written and performed by James Wetzel. Special thanks to Sam Mulvey, Rob Kelly, James Wetzel, Paul Rue, Tobiah Panshin, Scott Kramer, Kyle Hepworth, and Todd Maxfield Matsumoto. Please take the time to rate and review our show on iTunes and Stitcher, and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. And if you'd like to support the show financially, please consider becoming one of our Patreon subscribers. Even just $1 a month gives you access to exclusive episodes. And you can always find us online at radioversusthemartians.com.